KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Bay Area journalist Merrilee Strong has written a book that takes us into the dark world of men like Scott Peterson, who murder women they outwardly appear to love or are married to, and were provided in the book a much greater understanding of both the murderers and their victims and the criminal justice system that enables some literally to get away with murder. Merrilee Strong's book is called Erased, Missing Women, Murdered Wives, and she joins us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Oakland-based award-winning journalist Merrilee Strong is the author of A Bright Red Scream, a much-acclaimed book about the phenomenon of cutting and its connection to childhood trauma and abuse. Now, after 5 years of extensive research and prompted by the case in which Scott Peterson murdered his pregnant wife, Lacey, Merrilee Strong has published Erased, Missing Women, Murdered Wives. The book delves into some 50 cases in which women vanished or were found dead under suspicious circumstances that turned out to be domestic homicides. Merrilee Strong calls these killings, which are usually cold-blooded and premeditative, eraser killings, which she defines early on in the book as a form of intimate partner or domestic homicide committed almost exclusively by men and done in a carefully planned, cold-blooded manner. Merrilee Strong joins us for this forum hour, and welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And this was once, I guess, a crime that didn't have a name, but quickly with Scott Peterson, it did have a name as you began to see it. And that case, in many ways, is sort of the model of what you write about.
Well, I do take a long look at it in the book, and I covered the whole trial, all the legal proceedings against him. Heard all the evidence. And the thing with that case, as much, you know, heat and light that was brought to it, there really wasn't real illumination. You know, I think because these cases are so, I think they threaten us at the core, because this idea that, you know, they're really a crime of ultimate betrayal. We don't want to believe that somebody, you know, we invite into our home, into our own bed, could be capable of such monstrous cruelty. So we want to think, you know, it's just the stranger outside, you know, that's a danger to us, and that we can keep ourselves safe if we, you know, don't do things that would put us at risk. But yet, what these crimes, what that crime and then these others I started looking into after the Peterson case, you know, you keep hearing about these missing women, you know, grown women vanishing into thin air without a trace. And I had the feeling all along there was something deeper in the Peterson case, which, you know, I think played out, but also that it wasn't alone, that there are many of these cases. And I actually traced back a pattern going back a century ago, back to the original murder that inspired Theodore Dreiser's American Tragedy.
And then Chester Gillette.
Yes. And if you look back at that case, I mean, it's almost exactly like Scott Peterson. He was a man who had, you know, this fantasy of his life that he wanted. He was sort of for the poor relations, got a job working for his uncle where he was trying to hopefully become, you know, an important person in the world, make money. And his uncle had introduced him to this social circle that he wanted to be a part of. And he ended up getting a factory girl pregnant at the factory, his uncle's factory where he worked, and then plotted to kill her. And same thing with the Peterson case. You know, we want to think that these crimes, there's this belief that domestic homicide, it's a heat of passion, that, you know, a fight breaks out, the person kills without thinking. And in fact, there's something that's referred to as the domestic discount with domestic homicide, that these cases, it seemed, you know, even among juries, judges, prosecutors, there's a belief that these are somehow, you know, mitigated by the stresses of a marriage, that there's some understandable and justifiable reason that these men kill their wives. But in what I call eraser killings, these are crimes that are completely premeditated, meticulously planned in advance. For example, you know, in the Peterson case, he, you know, bought a boat, researched tidal patterns in the bay, decided where he was going to place his pregnant wife, manufactured homemade weights. All these steps it took, while at the same time he's taking her to holiday parties and toasting her and saying what a wonderful wife she is and how much he's looking forward to the baby. But there's this other level beneath for these men, this very, very dark side, this sort of Machiavellian side, where they're able to come up with these dark strategic plans and then honestly believe that they can get away with murder. This sense of entitlement they have is enormous.
And the arrogance and belief in their own almost infallibility or perfecting the perfect murder, that sort of thing, certainly comes across in a number of these cases. You mentioned Chester Gillette, 1906, prototype for Dreiser's American Tragedy. So Woody Allen in Matchpoint used that same prototype, and it keeps coming back in ways that are curious to me because I'm wondering just how much of a cultural phenomenon we have here. You talk about all these missing women and all these cases that may be allied to this, and yet you also say, well, they're small in number. This is kind of excessive pathology. I mean, are we talking about something that's a real portal to our culture is one of the questions I found myself fascinating on.
Well, I think it is because, you know, if you think about it, grown women don't just go missing. You know, we have instances where predators abduct children, and there are instances of serial killers and things like that, you know, making a woman disappear. But invariably, in these cases, when I looked into these missing women reports from Peterson on forward and then back in time, invariably it turned out it was the husband or boyfriend, the woman's intimate partner, had killed her and then staged the crime in a way to make it look like she had just gone missing. And then I saw a secondary pattern. So there was either what I call these eraser crimes, because it was either erasing the victim herself, getting rid of her body, getting rid of any evidence pointing to a crime scene so that it is just an open-ended mystery. I don't know what happened to her. She's gone. You know, I had nothing to do with it. The other case, the other sort of strain or part of this profile that I've come up with is that they don't erase the victim herself, but they erase the crime or their involvement in the crime. So in that case, the woman's body is left to be found, but they stage the scenario to look like it was either an accident, a suicide, or some other crime.
Kidnapping or robbery.
Right. Or carjacking. Yeah. We saw that in the Ray Carruth case. And people seem to draw like from their own milieu. So Ray Carruth, who was a football player in North Carolina, he staged the killing of his pregnant girlfriend, who was carrying a child he had no interest in supporting, to look like a carjacking. He actually hired men to come alongside of her, stop her car, and shoot her to death. She lived long enough to actually finger him. She ultimately died, and the baby was born, but is also has a lot of brain damage from the shooting.
Yeah, he just didn't want to pay support. I mean, that came down to the bottom line reason. And in fact, in the case of Scott Peterson, the pregnancy that his wife had with the child that was unborn named Connor was also pivotal, as you point out.
I found that an unwanted pregnancy is one of the most common reasons for eraser killings.
It's extraordinary, though, to think. You know, I remember we didn't even cover the Scott Peterson case. It was a little bit too tabloid for us. When we did cover the O.J. Simpson case, we looked at it from domestic violence. And what you learn from your book is many of these cases, there's no domestic violence. There's no record. There's no, I mean, like with O.J., that sort of thing. But it's extraordinary how many of these men think not only, as you pointed out, that they can get away with this sort of thing, but also how systematic they are in trying to follow through with the fantasy, I guess. I mean, one of the things I was struck with in the Peterson case was somebody asked him what was his favorite movie, and he said The Shining. Mm-hmm. I thought, boy, that's a Rorschach into this guy's head. You really got into these heads, so to speak, and you found an inner emptiness and desolation that's there in almost every case.
I think there are three basic psychological factors that play into these men's psychology. You know, at first people looked at it very simplistically and said things like, you know, Scott Peterson is a classic psychopath, but he's not a pure predator like we think of as a classic psychopath, say like a Jeffrey Dahmer or Ted Bundy. It's much more subtle. You know, all the men in my book were men who led productive lives, held down jobs, had relationships. Very few had criminal record. Many had no previous history of violence whatsoever. But yet they definitely have these psychopathic traits, that they're so callous, that they have no empathy at all for their victim, no remorse, that they really aren't able to attach in any way to other people. It's all on the surface. But they're great actors. They can fake it. And Peterson was one of the best. The other factors I think are involved are narcissism. These killers are incredibly narcissistic. And that is they have this great self-inflated image that they think that they're special, golden, and that they you know, people around them are just pawns in their own game to be used by them. And they believe that they're above the law and they're entitled to do what they want. So their attitude with these women is that, you know, at some point in their life, this woman is useful to them. But then they reach a stage where this woman is seen as an impediment. And it's often not even anything rational, but whatever life that they fantasize for themselves. And Peterson was a great example. When he, you know, he had this view of himself as like this international playboy. You know, he just lied about everything in his life. And they see these women, and often a child, as dead weight dragging them down.
A lot of self-aggrandizement, too, as you point out. The guy Hacker in Utah, who was looking at Scott Peterson as a kind of role model, I guess, in terms of how to... There are a number of people who have committed these eraser murders that you point out. Look to him, this guy making himself out as a medical student and just creating a whole kind of false life.
Yes, many of them that lead a double life.
They clash, though. I mean, and then suddenly there's this... But Jeffrey McDonald, you point out, with a wife and two kids. He murdered his wife and his two kids. Many people remember that case. And he said he didn't need him anymore. I mean, it was that simple. Why not get a divorce, as Mrs. Peterson, the mother, said? You know, why not, you know, or get an abortion, or, you know, it doesn't, on some level, it just doesn't even make sense. Maybe they want to be murderers.
It's strange because, yeah, to all, you know, to the rest of us, it seems like, why not get a divorce, or even just walk away, just abandon this person. I think if you could ever get Scott Peterson to answer that question, I think what he would probably say is, but it would have hurt Lacey if I divorced her. These men are so caught up in some image of themselves as this perfect person, this perfect husband, perfect father, that, you know, they can't just stand up and say, I want a divorce or I don't want a child. But then they will scheme in this incredibly callous way to get rid of them. And I think for some, they get this tremendous delight out of fooling people. And they live behind this mask, and so many of them have a double life. And it's strange. I mean, Mark Hacking.
Well, yeah, excuse me, Peterson loved, felt he was fooling the cops all along, and he was doing, you know, kind of a real vanity game with the police in terms of running around them and stuff. As
yes.
I recall, yeah.
They believe that they're smarter than everyone else. And they get off on this idea of fooling the police, you know, fooling everyone, all the relatives, and that they're able to do that, you know, lie to everyone they know, everyone who cares about them, and just perpetrate this charade for months or years on end. And like we're seeing now in this in Illinois with this police officer, Drew Peterson, who's suspected of disappearing his fourth wife and then looks like staging a drowning of his third wife in the bathtub, which he... If he was responsible, he got away with that crime initially. It was viewed as an accident. He seems to be seeking media attention, playing to the cameras. He even went on a radio show and wanted to be part of like a dating program while his wife is still freshly missing. They are so narcissistic that they have this constant need for attention. And I think some of them even view the fact, like with Scott Peterson, that... the sympathy factor, you know, it would look a lot better for him to be a widower, someone who had suffered this terrible tragedy, than to be a man who had divorced or somehow, you know, disappointed his wife by leaving her.
Something also very distressing in this whole, these portraits that you give us of these men that leads us to ask questions singularly about the Y chromosome and the culture of men. And you know, I know you you have a feminist background as a writer, which I'm sure you're proud of. One has to ask the question about, you know, you look at Dominic Dunn's TV show and you see these lady killers and, you know, black widows and all this sort of thing. But why it's almost predominantly men who go through this kind of thing that you're describing, this phenomenon psychologically that you're describing. What is it in the culture?
Well, I there are cases of women who kill their children. We know Susan Smith.
Yeah.
Andrea Yates. But I couldn't find any cases where, say, a woman killed her husband and her children. They might do one or the other. This phenomenon really seems to be a male-only phenomenon. I think women in general don't, even if they're, say, mentally ill or narcissistic, don't really have this sense of entitlement that they are, you know, completely entitled to take another person's life. Certainly women commit murder and women commit domestic homicide, but there's something very different with these men. They feel completely justified in what they're doing and absolutely no remorse. They rarely ever take any responsibility. They rarely ever plead guilty to this and rarely ever admit any involvement whatsoever.
And in many cases, as you point out in the book, it's hard really to pin these murders on them because women disappear. I mean, you have cases, horrible cases, where men chopping up bodies and their wives and things of that sort. But there's there's difficulty proving and convicting someone when there's not a body. And some of them try to take advantage of that.
They all hold this belief, what I call no body, no crime. This is a sort of folk belief in the popular culture that you can't prove murder without a body. And there was a time when some states did have such a prohibition, but it isn't the case. And I found law going back 50 years where a clear precedent was set that said this wasn't the case, that, you know, men who were clever enough to get rid of their victim were not to be given a free pass on murder. That sort of came about first with cases where, like, people were killed at sea and their bodies thrown overboard. And, you know, obviously there was no way to prove that person died. And 50 years ago was the first case where there was no confession, no corroborating evidence that a death had occurred. But a man in Los Angeles, the Ewing Scott case, another very interesting case, and a man very similar to Scott Peterson, who killed his wife and disappeared her, and she's never, ever been found, that precedent was established that circumstantial evidence is as strong, if not stronger, than direct evidence, which is really just eyewitness testimony, and that a strong case can be built on circumstantial evidence and these murders proven. But every guy falls into this belief that that isn't the case. And so that's, I think there's, that's the practical reason for disappearing their victims. But I think there's also a psychological reason as well, that they feel compelled to really erase this person from the book of their life. And you'll see that not only after they get rid of the body, they'll do strange things like immediately get rid of the woman's possessions, any kind of personal items, give them away. And this is one of the things that's often used against them, showing a consciousness of guilt. But they seem literally compelled to sort of wipe out all memory of this person.
Yeah, speaking about consciousness of guilt, you talk about this Dr. Robert Birnbaum, who said at one point, well, the problem with Claus von Bülow is he left the evidence. And, you know, somebody made a joke once about, well, what happened to your wife? And he immediately got really sort of paranoid and had a very strong reaction. It's almost as if under the surface is that sense of guilt. And yet, surprisingly, these are men who feel very little guilt and, very, as you say, very little remorse.
Yes, I don't think they feel any guilt or remorse. I think it's just, there's a fear of being caught. That man, he kept moving around different parts of the country.
Hoping, he was a physician, we should say.
Yes. Maybe, yeah. He was a surgeon and a man with probably a genius IQ who it's believed that he killed his wife and then took her body. He was a pilot, rented an airplane, and they believe he dropped it out over the Atlantic. He got away with it for decades because nobody was ever found. At one point, actually, they found a torso they thought was his wife. Her family was buried this torso, believing it was their daughter. Her parents died without ever knowing that it wasn't her. That body part was later exhumed and turned out not to be her. He was finally prosecuted, I think it was 20 or 25 years later, based on wholly circumstantial evidence, and was convicted. But he had kept trying to go on with his life and hide from this. And in fact, he wouldn't let his staff in his medical office open his mail. And it was really just people looking into this, some women he dated that noticed strange things about him. And this anecdote that you mentioned where one of them jokingly said, you know, what'd you do, kill your wife? When he was guarded about the fact that he'd had a wife. And he said, what do you know? they do have a fear about being discovered, but they don't have any regret or shame for what they've done.
Talking with Marilee Strong, her new book is Erased, Missing Women, Murdered Wives. It's pretty grim, a lot of it, and I think it's safe to say that Marilee's become a forensic expert in these 5 years of her research, along with so many of these cases. One of the cases that really struck many of us is a case of Einhorn, Ira Einhorn, who, again, outwardly, there were so many people who believed in this guy. He was an environmentalist, he was a crusader, he was a pacifist. People absolutely refused to believe that he would be capable of killing his girlfriend, which he did. And again, there's that outer self, the actor, whatever it is, as opposed to this life of, this lethal life, this inner murderer life. You also talk about the system and the need to reform the system from many of the cases that you study here. An investigation system is part of it, but also missing person loophole and starting investigation from ground zero. I mean, you actually talk about reforms that are necessary from all the research and study of these different cases. And let's talk about these, particularly in terms of investigations. I mean, there simply aren't the tools right now that are being used that should be used or could be used.
Well, in the Einhorn's case, for an example, he, this was back in the 70s, he killed his girlfriend when she was making it clear she was going to leave him. He bashed her over the head, and while she was still alive, he put her into a steamer trunk, which he kept locked in his closet, where she died in that trunk. He was able to keep police out of the apartment for a year and a half. He wouldn't allow anyone in to look around. And the thing with these killers is, you know, he didn't actually report his girlfriend, Holly Maddox, missing, but some of these other men do, but yet then they won't let police search what would be ground zero for any investigation of a missing person, which would be that woman's home. So it wasn't until 18 months later that in her case, tragically, when police finally got a warrant to come in and they found her body mummified in the suitcase, the fact that men hide behind these constitutional protections, the right to silence, this concept that, you know, a man's home is his castle and so should not be subjected to unreasonable search and seizure. Well, is it really unreasonable that an investigation shouldn't be allowed to begin at the woman's own home if she shares it with that man? You know, even there might be evidence pointing to something completely different, you know, that you want to look in her computer, you want to look in her diary, you want to see if there's any clues about where she may have gone. But these men use the system in a way that protects them and really deprives the victim of any civil rights at all.
So what would be the first thing in order here in terms of rectifying this broken system?
Well, I think we have to get much more reasonable about this search issue. Also, when women go missing, as I've said, since this isn't something that, you know, these aren't crimes with no explanation, all the women, I write about more than 50 different eraser killings in Erased, and all of the victims in those cases were women who were, they didn't have any risk factors that would have put them at risk for violent crime. They weren't involved in any, you know, lifestyle or habits like that that would have put them at risk. They all were very close with their relatives, had children, you know, left behind their cars, their purses, their wallets, took no money. I mean, there was no reason to believe these women were just missing. So I think one reform that definitely needs to happen is when someone is, you know, these cases have to be triaged. They can't just be treated as like runaways or walkaways. When a woman, you know, disappears without taking her children, that's a likely homicide. And
although the police often do assume it's a runaway or has domestic unhappiness or, you know, took off with a lover or whatever.
Yes, and especially women of a certain age group, older teens or young adults fall through the cracks because they're viewed as a demographic likely to run away. But, you know, when all evidence to the contrary, I write about a case that I believe Scott Peterson was particularly influenced by when he lived.
A smart case?
Yes. Mm-hmm. When he lived in San Luis Obispo, when he went to college, he lived, worked, and went to school there, and three different co-eds went missing. Two, it turned out, were killed by a serial killer. Third appears to have been killed, or the suspect is a fellow college student who walked her home from a party. She never made it back to her dorm. And the police believe he was the killer, but they have never charged him. And they put out these messages that, you know, basically, they literally said to the media, you know, unless he confesses to us, there's nothing more we can do. And so this idea of nobody, no crime, nothing can be done. And they did all the things wrong. That case is a classic example of if you don't act quickly, if you don't do all the right things, you can't get evidence to ever make a case.
Well, let me bring you, our callers, into this. You may want to ask questions or make a comment on what you're hearing here about this whole notion of erased missing women. Murdered Wives by award-winning Oakland journalist Marilee Strong. You can join us toll-free, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with journalist and author Marilee Strong. She'll be at Book Passage in Corte Madera at 1 p.m. on Tuesday, April 1st. She's the author of a book called Erased. And as the book says, they vanished into thin air, were found dead under mysterious circumstances. They were victims of the ultimate betrayal, murdered by the men they loved and trusted. And there's a picture in this edition that I'm looking at of a married couple, and the photograph is shattered. We're going to go to your calls and emails here forthwith. I'm just wanting to know, though, more about what you see. This is a feminist issue. This is a political issue in terms of public policy. And what, again, you see as necessary reform.
Well, another aspect that needs reform is our whole death investigation system. There is no uniform system across the country for this. And in some jurisdictions, you have coroners who have no medical training at all. They're elected officials. There have literally been people who've been hairdressers, accountants, gas station attendants who've held this job. And while they don't do autopsies themselves, they control, basically, they have the power to really control what's done. So if they don't find a death, you know, adequately suspicious, they may not order x-rays that could reveal that the person had actually been beaten, had a skull fracture, or say toxicology tests that would reveal poisoning. And there, another part of the system is this issue of the right to silence. One of the eraser killers I write about in the book, Dr. Barton Corbin in Florida, or excuse me, in Georgia, he was a dentist. Yes, he first killed his girlfriend while in dental school, a classmate. He staged the killing to look like a suicide. He had her propped up on the couch, a gun at her side, one bullet in the temple. There was the friends and neighbors and relatives told police that he had been stalking her, threatening her. She feared for her life. Yet the case was closed. It was ruled as a suicide, although they weren't really sure. They couldn't rule out homicide, but case closed. He went on 14 years later, got married, decided to eliminate that wife in the exact same way. And probably the single most astonishing thing I found researching this book is that if men get away with this once, they will do it again in many cases, and often using this exact same plan. And
didn't he the second time think that he was going to learn from Scott Peterson's mistake?
Yes. He, with his wife, who he killed, watched the Scott Peterson trial intensely, and relatives remember him saying, what Peterson did wrong was he talked too much. That was his mistake. So when Barton Corbin killed his wife, he wouldn't talk at all. He wouldn't give any statement to police. In fact, he wouldn't even come pick up his children, who he allowed to find their mother. And then when they were brought to the police station, he wouldn't even come and pick them up and comfort them. And he continued to maintain his innocence, never spoke to the media, never spoke to police, hid behind that right to silence. On the eve of trial, the authorities were finally able to trace the gun to him. Only then did he end up pleading guilty to avoid the death penalty. But otherwise, he would have gone to trial like so many of these men do, claiming that it's a rush to judgment, the system's against them, and that they weren't responsible.
We're going to take your phone calls again. We're talking to Marilee Strong. Her book is called Erased. And Martha, you're our first caller. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I wanted to mention the trial that's currently going on in Oakland of the computer programmer Hans Reisser and his missing wife. I don't know if it's permissible. I mean, I guess it's, maybe you wouldn't want to talk about it because they haven't finished the trial, but it fits exactly the pattern and the type of person, the type of man that you've been talking about. He believes he's a genius. He's just a... been reading it in detail. I wondered if you knew anything about it and could comment on it.
You're familiar with the case, aren't you, Marilee?
Yes. In fact, I sat in on the trial for several weeks, and he psychologically seems very much to fit this profile. Yes, he considers himself a genius. Went to college at Berkeley when he was still a teenager, developed this file system, and was involved in this very ugly, contentious divorce with his wife, who was a Russian immigrant who he had met over there, brought over. And in fact, there are many stories in my book of men who, view their wives basically as like, a mail-order bride kind of situation.
Well, there is one, Thomas Lane, who you write about, who had a mail-order bride from the Philippines, and then he decided, well, this isn't useful for me anymore. I'll just, again, replace her, find another one.
And he staged her death as a bathtub drowning, when in actuality he broke into the apartment, held her under the water till she died. And he was actually, that man was actually quoted as saying before he killed his wife, if I could do what Peterson did and get away with it, I'd do it. And sure enough, 3 weeks later, he tried to do it.
Let me thank the caller. Let me go to more of our calls, and we go next to John in San Francisco. Morning, John.
Good morning. First of all, I'd like to comment on hiding behind the right to silence, quote unquote. It's not hiding behind the right to silence. The right to silence is a constitutional right. It's a very cherished one, and I think your guest should reconsider her thoughts on that. But secondly, I'd like to ask your guest to comment on the Jeffrey McDonald case, where it took a very, very persistent father-in-law to get the police to actually go after Jeff McDonald. And I was wondering how often that situation comes up where the police are just not going to do anything because they don't think they have enough evidence to file against the suspect. And the other case I'd like to ask your guest to comment on is the Sam Shepard case, where he was actually, after being found guilty, was found not guilty. And how often does that happen?
Okay, thank you for the call. A number of things there. First, he's talking about maybe you're reconsidering hiding behind the Constitution.
Well, I'm not saying we should get rid of the, you know, that you have to incriminate yourself. But I think when there's an investigation of a missing person, you know, providing information to the police about that person is not, you know, inappropriate. You know, say you work in a bank and money's stolen, you know, gone from your till, you have to give some kind of accounting for it. You don't have to admit you stole it, but, you know, there is a certain inquiry that you should cooperate with, and maybe a lack of cooperation in an investigation is something that should come into trial. In the McDonald case, yes, very often it's the family members who are the ones that get justice in these cases. Numerous of the stories I write about in my book, it took family members pursuing it on their own, forcing authorities to take action. There was one case where the victim's sister literally went into the apartment, found that the mattress in their bedroom had been turned over and it was all bloody on the other side. She knew then something very bad had happened to her sister. She personally risked her life trying to investigate the case. And the husband then hired a man to try to kill her as well, telling him to do it exactly the same way he had done the wife, by killing her, leaving just a little blood, and then disappearing the body. In the Shepard case, I don't believe he was guilty, so I think that is a I actually studied that case a long time ago, and I think there is clear evidence that he wasn't responsible. I don't know of any of these eraser killings where a man was convicted and it was ever proven he didn't do it. In fact, what you find with most of the killings I'm writing about, these men, at most, they're only usually charged with second-degree murder because of this idea of this domestic discount, this belief that these are heat-of-passion killings. And in all the cases I write about, I think just all of them, where it was second-degree murder conviction, there was evidence of premeditation where they had started putting a plan in order, had bought a weapon. I mean, one guy who they discovered after he claimed his wife and he were taking a moonlit walk on a beach, and they were accosted by a man who shot them both, her fatally. He tried to carry her to safety, wasn't able to, drove his car 10 miles till he finally flagged down a passerby to call for help. Turned out he'd passed all these homes and businesses, didn't stop in there for help, and his answer for that was that he didn't want to bother people if their lights were out. In that case, they discovered that 6 months before the killing, he had researched on his computer gunshot wound right chest. Sure enough, the wound he ended up with 6 months later was gunshot wound right chest. It's hard to believe that somebody would go to the point of actually shooting themselves as a cover story to get away with murder. But this is what I'm talking about, this kind of premeditation, that these aren't heat of passion crimes, that they're premeditated.
And they're so cold-blooded.
Really first-degree murders.
They are first-degree because they're so cold-blooded and premeditated. But one has to ask the question about, I mean, you give a psychological profile of these men, and yet traditional psychology really seems to fail us here. I was thinking about this the other night, just seeing something about Jeffrey Dahmer, and his parents were portrayed as being loving. And, you know, I mean, if you're looking for Oedipus complexes or you're looking for those kinds of things here and trying to connect dots, it just doesn't work, does it?
Well, in
Scott Peterson have problems with his mother that we know of, that kind of
well,
thing?
In the Peterson case, there was this three-generation legacy of abandonment and loss in his family. His maternal grandfather was murdered when his mother was just 2 years old in what appeared to be a robbery at his business. The maternal grandmother, who also had a physical illness, scleroderma, which is a very severe and frightening disease where the skin and the tissue around the internal organs hardens, and it's like turning to stone. So either for these physical reasons or for psychological reasons, trying to grapple with her husband's murder, she put all of the kids, Scott's mother and her three brothers, into an orphanage where they were then raised until they basically reached high school age and had to be let out. this orphanage was a very Dickensian place with lots of deprivation and cruelty and God knows all what happened there. When his mother got out, she immediately started getting pregnant and gave first one baby away and then another baby away. There's some talk that she considered giving her third baby away and was talked out of it. I'm not sure if that is true, but she did keep that child. Then when she married Scott's father, it was like this was almost like making up for everything in life, and all this attention was paid to him. He was sort of kept to a whole different standard from the rest of the family. He was this golden boy. They even called him that. They called, you know, he was perfect in their eyes. I mean, I couldn't believe it at trial after hearing all this evidence against him, hearing the man on these tapes, seeing somebody who cared nothing about his wife and child. They were still describing him as this perfect child. So I think there was both this sense of, you know, this sort of inherited sense of, you know, ambivalence at the very least towards children, a sense that children were disposable or that at least unilaterally one could make a decision to get rid of children. And then on top of that was a, sort of this like narcissistic parenting that he was so special and perfect and could do no wrong, and they would always bail him out. And so I think there were a combination of factors in
That's specific to his case. In other words, you're talking about a psychological profile of men that doesn't necessarily fit patterns of abandonment and loss in every case. In fact, some of them come from what could be described or characterized as nurturing homes or certainly ordinary type of homes, at least maybe on the surface. Who knows what was underneath, but nevertheless, there's a pathology here in terms of the effects, but the causes remain sometimes really very difficult to get at.
Yeah, I think there's still always the nature versus nurture argument. You know, we don't really know what causes these things. With all these men, we see this psychopathic trait to some level where they really lack empathy, can't bond with other people.
And the self-aggrandizement and the kind of false fantasy of a life that doesn't exist.
They're inveterate liars and to the point, I mean, we're not talking about little garden variety fabrications, but literally leading completely double lives in many cases. Like Mark Hacking, where he, you know, was pretending to be a doctor, had everyone fooled thinking he was going off to medical school, when in fact he'd never even graduated from college. But he would go to such lengths, he would, you know, pretend to write papers. He'd bring books home. At where he worked, they had a little room set aside so he could study. All of this was phony. And then with these men, often it's when these secrets are about to be revealed is when that they kill. And in his case, his wife had called the school to ask about student housing and was told he's not even enrolled. He never applied. It was all a lie. And I think he was able to convince her maybe briefly, but he knew time was running out. The truth was going to come out. And then he ended up shooting her in her sleeve.
Some emails. Graham writes, very interesting show as usual. It sounds like every homicide detective should read this book. What are the chances of this material being introduced in a police training?
Well, one of the goals I had hoped was that, I mean, I think we need at every level, from police investigation, death investigation with, you know, coroners and medical examiners, prosecutors in charging these cases, judges and juries with how to decide them. That's why I gave it this name, because until we recognize that this is a pattern, we don't know how to respond to these cases. They're only seen in isolation, and so this myth can continue to be perpetuated that these are heat of passion crimes, that, you know, something happened that, you know, even during the Peterson case, I couldn't believe how many reporters still wanted to think that, well, something must have happened. You know, Lacey found out about his affair and a fight broke out. Maybe he killed her accidentally. Even when there's no evidence pointing to that, people and many jurors want to hang on to that belief because we just don't want to think that somebody, you know, we trust could betray us in that way. But by continuing to believe in that, these cases don't get resolved. Deaths go uninvestigated or unpunished, and there really is no justice for the victims.
In fact, you intimate a number of occasions in your book, and just from what you said today, that there probably are many missing women who we have no idea what happened, and in many instances this may indeed be what happened. But because of lack of police tools or lack of police work or lack of ability to find any kind of proof, they're out there. Phil, you're next up. Good morning.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, Phil, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I went to school in San Luis Obispo and had a friend that worked at a restaurant where Lacey and Peter owned, or Lacey and Scott Peterson owned. And she said that she witnessed a lot of verbal abuse by Lacey, and Scott would just brush it off on the surface, but when she would go into the back stock room, she witnessed Scott punching boxes and taking it out on inanimate objects. I'm wondering if he doesn't feel, could possibly not feel remorse because he somehow feels, you know, that his actions were justified.
I certainly believe he does think his actions were justified. Men with these narcissistic traits think of themselves as the victim. You know, they don't ever see other people as having rights and, you know, protections, you know, or any kind of rights of their own. In Scott's case, he had a very strange psychology. I've never really seen anyone like him because he was kind of passive aggressive. He was, you know, the day before he was arrested, when, you know, he must have been the most stressful week of his life. The bodies were in the process of being identified after they had come to the surface of the bay. And the last day of freedom, even though he's all the way near the Mexican border, seemingly hiding out from police, not calling to inquire about anything in the case, the last thing he does is he's doing his taxes. I mean, there was this way that he seemed to be able to compartmentalize and repress things to such an extraordinary level. And so with these men in the book, they're not violent toward other people. The only people they seem to be violent toward, this aggression in their lives seems to be directed toward the women and or children that they're responsible for, and then occasionally someone else that tries to bring them to justice, another family member, whoever they think, say in the McDonald case or this woman I was saying where her sister investigated the case. There was another man, a lawyer in Tennessee, who managed to get away with disappearing his wife for 10 years, eventually moved to Mexico, and charges were brought. And that was a case that was really solved by her parents just pursuing it endlessly. He then, from his jail cell, tried to hire a hitman to kill the parents. And in his mind, even though there was evidence and there was all kind of other part to the case, they fixate on this one thing and they think, you know, if I can just eliminate those people, everything will fall apart and I'll be a free man. They don't really think rationally. They're not insane. It's not that they're legally not responsible. They know what they're doing. They know what's wrong. They just don't care.
Plus, they think it's going to follow the script in their mind in so many instances. I mean, they've got it all laid out, and it's going to be a perfect murder and all that sort of thing. When you get into these minds, as you have, I mean, how does it affect you ultimately? It sort of reminds me of, you know, actors or actresses who have to play a certain role and, you know, method acting kind of thing or something like that. You know, you get into their minds, really, don't you?
It was, you know, a dark period of time, you know, just spending so much time with this all these murdered women. And I guess in my work, I try to give voice to people who can't speak for themselves. And what's so tragic to me about these killings is that, you know, the victims are truly silenced. They can't even offer up their bodies as evidence against their killers. So what I try to do is tell their stories, show the pattern so people can identify it, so that, you know, in some way can bring, I don't believe there's closure ever for these families, but there is some accounting for what happened to them.
And we'll bring more of our callers in. Maury from Oakland, morning.
Yes, good morning. My name is Maury, and I'm so grateful that this subject is getting serious attention. This happened to my mother in 1995. She was married and still is legally married to her husband, who is a disbarred criminal attorney in Guam, where she was living at the time. And she just disappeared without a trace, and my family suspects that her husband was involved. But he does fit the psychological profile that Ms. Strong has discussed, and we do believe that he has something to do with it, either directly or maybe hired someone to do it. But the police have said there's no concrete evidence. We can't really do much more than hope someone comes forward, an eyewitness, or something is discovered, a body, or what have you. And so it's just been a very long and difficult process for me, and but I'm just grateful to hear that this has been written about and know that this is happening to other people, and because if one talks to other victims or other family members, you often do feel like you're very alone in the experience, and it really is. Not having a body, you can't put so-called closure on the experience as you can with a traumatic death where there's a murder or something, where you can actually have some kind of put it to rest for yourself.
I'm so sorry you had to go through all that. You've had to go through all this.
Thank you.
And thank you for letting us know and talking to us this morning. I appreciate your hearing from you. I want to go to another caller. Rosetta, good morning.
Oh, hi, yeah. Am I on the radio?
You're on the air, yes.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay. Yeah, my daughter was murdered February 22nd, 2001 by her ex-husband. He didn't want to pay child support, and I believe this was an eraser killing without actually him. Well, he ran away from the site, and he left very, very, very little evidence. And he was in jail for 3 years before he finally told the court, you know, that no contest. He never pleaded guilty, and he never admitted that he did it. But anyway, the reason I'm calling is because I remember Ms. Strong was mentioning, you know, how there's not a triage done when somebody disappears. Well, also, when women complain or when they report domestic violence, you know, it's not triaged either. And if there are certain people, you know, that you know, are more prone to commit murder than others, and that's obvious when you look at the situation. And then the other thing is, a few years ago, I got a call from a professor in University of Arizona, and he was working on this death review initiative, and it was coming out of Congress. I guess it was in the Clinton administration where they set aside money for this, and they wanted to look at, you know, suspicious deaths of women in, you know, in every locality. And so they have a death review committee for children for whenever there's child abuse involved or whenever children die mysteriously. And so this was a quest for a death review committee for women who, you know, were found on the railroad tracks or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. And I was wondering if she, if Ms. Strong has heard if this is actually coming to fruition or not.
Marilee Strong?
I don't know about that specifically. I think we can and should look toward the reforms that have been instituted regarding missing children as something of a model or a jumping-off point for investigating these cases of missing women. With children, you know, there's all kinds of strictures in place now. There we have guidelines for how to investigate those cases, because there's a recognition that children, if there's a, you know, believed stranger abduction, that children are endangered very quickly, and so things have to move rapidly. You know, we have Amber Alerts, we have all these ideas.
Same principle ought to operate here, you're saying, really?
Well, I'm not saying we can have an Amber Alert for missing women, but...
but I mean quick response, immediate
right.
response.
Instead of letting these cases just languish, I mean, you'd be surprised how many never even advance to the point of a homicide investigation. They're just left in a drawer somewhere. This woman in San Luis Obispo, Kristen Smart, even though, you know, she disappeared from school, did not touch her bank account, had nothing but the clothes on her back, her and her room key, no money, no way of surviving, doesn't call anybody in her family. And months later, the police are calling it, saying that they don't see any sign of foul play, and they're calling it missing under unusual circumstances. I don't even know what that means. But obviously, something's gone wrong there. And, you know, we need to start taking these cases seriously. They can't all just be taken individually, but we have to see the pattern and respond accordingly.
And let me thank the caller, Rosetta, and go to an anonymous caller. Good morning.
Good morning. Hello?
Hi. Yeah, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. When I started hearing this, I started getting chills because I think I'm involved with someone who could possibly be, who could possibly maybe try to erase me one day. Because he has a lot of that narcissism, and I've been thinking to myself over and over, you know, do I marry this guy or not? And like Oprah says, you get pebbles on your head, then you get a boulder, and I think this is a pebble. So it's really kind of freaking me out. He fits all of these characteristics, and I've caught him in so many lies, and so has the family, and it's like, you know, just like he lives in a fantasy world.
I don't think it's necessary to be Dr. Laura to say you need some real consideration here before you go ahead and do something the way you've described. Any advice from you, Marilee?
Well, one of the reasons I wrote the book was to try to look back at some of these cases, and like Peterson in particular, because he was so good at hiding things. You know, everyone really thought he was the perfect husband. And, you know, looking back, I was able to find things, these warning signs, where he made these statements of, you know, hoping for infertility with his wife and, you know, and these very scary things. But, you know, people at the time just took them as jokes, didn't take it seriously. I would say, you know, follow your instincts if you feel that way. Some, you know, if there are warning signs for these men, this kind of lying I'm talking about, this really, you know, richly elaborated lying over long periods of time, hidden lives, secret lives. I mean, invariably, these men had something in their life. I mean, sometimes whole other pseudo-marriages were going on, hiding legal problems, other things. And then just this attitude that, you know, toward the women in their lives, toward the children in their lives. But it's very hard to see. It's very hard to see in advance.
Well, I wish that woman good luck. And Marilee, thank you for bringing this out into the public here with your new book, Erased, Missing Women, Murdered Wives. Congratulations on doing the book. It's been 5 years in the works. We're here with you Monday through Friday, and an hour is repeated in the evening. Marilee Strong will be at Book Passage in Corte Madera, 1 p.m. on Tuesday, April the 1st. We'll be in Oakland on Monday, March 31st, hosting a special live broadcast on caregiving from the Downtown Oakland Senior Center. And we started the conversation online. What toll does caring for a loved one take? What are the rewards? You can join the conversation simply by going to kqed.org/healthdialogues. And I want to extend happy birthday wishes to Dan Zoligan, our senior editor, and thank our producer, Kevin Guillory, and our production assistants, Tina Lauerberg, Inga Schrabsdorf, Polly Stryker, and Nick Vidinsky. Also, thanks to our interns, Rania Ahmed, Julie Barsamian, Nicole Beckley, Susan Breton, and Kevin Lee. Our engineer is Dave Freeman, executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.